and second to none, said the pilgrim, who had stood near enough to hear and had listened to this conversation with marked impatience. All turned toward the spot from whence this unexpected asseveration was heard. I say, repeated the pilgrim in a firm and strong voice, that the English chivalry were second to none who ever drew sword in defence of the Holy Land. I say besides, for I saw it, that King Richard himself and five of his knights held a tournament after the taking of St. John de Acre as challengers against all comers. I say that on that day each knight ran three courses and cast to the ground three antagonists. I add that seven of these assailants were knights of the Temple, and Sir Brian de Bois Guilbert well knows the truth of what I tell you. It is impossible for language to describe the bitter scowl of rage which rendered yet darker the swarthy countenance of the Templar. In the extremity of his resentment and confusion, his quivering fingers griped towards the handle of his sword, and perhaps only withdrew from the consciousness that no act of violence could be safely executed in that place and presence. Cedric, whose feelings were all of a right onward and simple kind, and were seldom occupied by more than one object at once, omitted, in the joyous glee with which he heard of the glory of his countrymen, to remark the angry confusion of his guest. I would give thee this golden bracelet, pilgrim, couldst thou tell me the names of those knights who upheld so gallantly the renown of Merry England. That will I do blithely, replied the pilgrim, and that without guerdon. My oath for a time prohibits me touching gold.
I will wear the bracelet for you, if you will, friend Palmer, said Wamba.
The first in honour as in arms, in renown as in place, said the pilgrim, was the brave Richard, King of England. I forgive him, said Cedric. I forgive him his descent from the tyrant Duke William. The Earl of Leicester was the second, continued the pilgrim. Sir Thomas Malton of Gilsland was the third.
Of Saxon descent, he at least, said Cedric with exultation.
Sir Fulke Doyley the fourth, said the pilgrim.
Saxon also, at least by the mother's side,
continued Cedric, who listened with the utmost eagerness, and forgot, in part at least, his hatred to the Normans in the common triumph of the King of England and his islanders.
And who was the fifth? He demanded.
The fifth was Sir Edwin Turnham.
Genuine Saxon by the soul of Hengist, shouted Cedric. And the sixth, he continued, with eagerness. How name you the sixth?
The sixth, said the palmer, after a pause, in which he seemed to recollect himself, was a young knight of lesser renown and lower rank, assumed into that honourable company less to aid their enterprise than to make up their numbers. His name dwells not in my memory.
Sir Palmer, said Sir Brian de Bois Guilbert scornfully, this assumed forgetfulness, after so much has been remembered, comes too late to serve your purpose. I will myself tell the name of the knight before whose lance fortune and my horse's fault occasioned my falling. It was the knight of Ivanhoe. Nor was there one of the six that, for his years, had more renown in arms. Yet this will I say, and loudly, that were he in England, and durst repeat in this week's tournament the challenge of St. John de Acre, I, mounted and armed as I now am, would give him every advantage of weapons and abide the result.
Your challenge would be soon answered, replied the palmer, were your antagonist near you. As the matter is, disturb not the peaceful hall with vaunts of the issue of a conflict, which you well know cannot take place. If Ivanhoe ever returns from Palestine, I will be his surety that he meets you.
A goodly security, said the Knight Templar. And what do you proffer as a pledge?
This reliquary, said the palmer, taking a small ivory box from his bosom and crossing himself, containing a portion of the true cross, brought from the monastery of Mount Carmel. The prior of Jorvaux crossed himself and repeated a pater noster, in which all devoutly joined, excepting the Jew, the Mohammedans, and the Templar,
the latter of whom, without veiling his bonnet or testifying any reverence for the alleged sanctity of the relic, took from his neck a gold chain, which he flung on the board, saying, "Let Prior Aymer hold my pledge, and that of this nameless vagrant, in token that when the Knight of Ivanhoe comes within the four seas of Britain, he underlies the challenge of Brian de Bois-Guilbert, which, if he answer not, I will proclaim him as a coward on the walls of every temple court in Europe."
"It will not need," said the Lady Rowena, breaking silence. "My voice shall be heard, if no other in this hall is raised on behalf of the absent Ivanhoe. I affirm he will meet fairly every honourable challenge. Could my weak warrant add security to the inestimable pledge of this holy pilgrim, I would pledge name and fame that Ivanhoe gives this proud knight the meeting he desires." A crowd of conflicting emotions seemed to have occupied Cedric and kept him silent during this discussion. Gratified pride, resentment, embarrassment chased each other over his broad and open brow like the shadow of cloud drifting over a harvest field, whilst his attendants, on whom the name of the sixth knight seemed to produce an effect almost electrical, hung in suspense upon their master's looks. But when Rowena spoke, the sound of her voice seemed to startle him from his silence.
"Lady," said Cedric, "this beseems not. Were further pledge necessary, I myself, offended, and justly offended as I am, would yet gage my honour for the honour of Ivanhoe. But the wager of battle is complete, even according to the fantastic fashions of Norman chivalry. Is it not, Father Aymer?"
"It is," replied the prior, "and the blessed relic and rich chain will I bestow safely in the treasury of our convent until the decision of this warlike challenge."
Having thus spoken, he crossed himself again and again, and after many genuflections and muttered prayers, he delivered the reliquary to Brother Ambrose, his attendant monk, while he himself swept up with less ceremony, but perhaps with no less internal satisfaction, the golden chain, and bestowed it in a pouch lined with perfumed leather, which opened under his arm.
"And now, Sir Cedric," he said, "my ears are chiming vespers with the strength of your good wine. Permit us another pledge to the welfare of the fair Lady Rowena, and indulge us with liberty to pass to our repose."
"By the rood of Bromholm," said the Saxon, "you do but small credit to your fame, Sir Prior. Report speaks you a bonny monk that would hear the matin chime ere he quitted his bowl, and old as I am, I fear to have shame in encountering you. But by my faith, a Saxon boy of 12 in my time would not so soon have relinquished his goblet."
The prior had his own reasons, however, for persevering in the course of temperance which he had adopted. He was not only a professional peacemaker, but from practice a hater of all feuds and brawls. It was not altogether from a love to his neighbour, or to himself, or from a mixture of both. On the present occasion, he had an instinctive apprehension of the fiery temper of the Saxon, and saw the danger that the reckless and presumptuous spirit, of which his companion had already given so many proofs, might at length end by producing some disagreeable explosion. He therefore gently insinuated the incapacity of the native of any other country engaging in the genial conflict of the bowl with the hardy and strong-headed Saxons. Something he mentioned but slightly about his own holy character, and ended by pressing his proposal to depart to repose. The grace cup was accordingly served round, and the guests, after making deep obeisance to their landlord and to the Lady Rowena, arose and mingled in the hall, while the heads of the family, by separate doors, retired with their attendants.
"Unbelieving dog," said the Templar to Isaac the Jew as he passed him in the throng. "Dost thou bend thy course to the tournament?"
"I do so purpose," replied Isaac, bowing in all humility, "if it please your reverend valour."
"Aye," said the knight, "to gnaw the bowels of our nobles with usury, and to gull women and boys with gauds and toys. I warrant thee store of shekels in thy Jewish scrip."
"Not a shekel, not a silver penny, not a halfling, so help me the God of Abraham,"
said the Jew, clasping his hands.
I go but to seek the assistance of some brethren of my tribe to aid me to pay the fine which the exchequer of the Jews have imposed upon me. Father Jacob, be my speed. I am an impoverished wretch. The very gabardine I wear is borrowed from Reuben of Tadcaster.
The Templar smiled sourly as he replied, Beshrew thee for a false-hearted liar! And, passing onward, as if disdaining farther conference, he communed with his Muslim slaves in a language unknown to the bystanders. The poor Israelite seemed so staggered by the address of the military monk that the Templar had passed on to the extremity of the hall ere he raised his head from the humble posture which he had assumed, so far as to be sensible of his departure. And when he did look around, it was with the astounded air of one at whose feet a thunderbolt has just burst, and who hears still the astounding report ringing in his ears. The Templar and Prior were shortly after marshalled to their sleeping apartments by the steward and the cupbearer, each attended by two torchbearers and two servants carrying refreshments, while servants of inferior condition indicated to their retinue and to the other guests their respective places of repose. Chapter 6. To buy his favour, I extend this friendship. If he will take it, so. If not, adieu. And for my love, I pray you wrong me not. Merchant of Venice. As the palmer, lighted by a domestic with a torch, passed through the intricate combination of apartments of this large and irregular mansion, the cupbearer, coming behind him, whispered in his ear that if he had no objection to a cup of good mead in his apartment, there were many domestics in that family who would gladly hear the news he had brought from the Holy Land, and particularly that which concerned the Knight of Ivanhoe. Wamba presently appeared to urge the same request, observing that a cup after midnight was worth three after curfew. Without disputing a maxim urged by such grave authority, the palmer thanked them for their courtesy, but observed that he had included in his religious vow an obligation never to speak in the kitchen on matters which were prohibited in the hall. "That vow," said Wamba to the cupbearer, "would scarce suit a serving man." The cupbearer shrugged his shoulders in displeasure. "I thought to have lodged him in the solaire chamber," said he, "but since he is so unsocial to Christians, e'en let him take the next stall to Isaac the Jews. Anwald," said he to the torchbearer, "carry the pilgrim to the southern cell. I give you good night," he added, "Sir Palmer, with small thanks for short courtesy." "Good night, and our lady's benison," said the palmer with composure, and his guide moved forward. In a small antechamber, into which several doors opened, and which was lighted by a small iron lamp, they met a second interruption from the waiting maid of Rowena, who, saying in a tone of authority that her mistress desired to speak with the pilgrim, took the torch from the hand of Anwald, and, bidding him await her return, made a sign to the palmer to follow. Apparently he did not think it proper to decline this invitation as he had done the former, for, though his gesture indicated some surprise at the summons, he obeyed it without answer or remonstrance. A short passage and an ascent of seven steps, each of which was composed of a solid beam of oak, led him to the apartment of the Lady Rowena, the rude magnificence of which corresponded to the respect which was paid to her by the lord of the mansion. The walls were covered with embroidered hangings, on which different coloured silks, interwoven with gold and silver threads, had been employed with all the art of which the age was capable to represent the sports of hunting and hawking. The bed was adorned with the same rich tapestry, and surrounded with curtains dyed with purple. The seats had also their stained coverings, and one which was higher than the rest was accommodated with a footstool of ivory, curiously carved. No less than four silver candelabra, holding great waxen torches, served to illuminate this apartment. Yet let not modern beauty envy the magnificence of a Saxon princess. The walls of the apartment were so ill-finished and so full of crevices that the rich hangings shook to the night blast, and in despite of a sort of screen intended to protect them from the wind,
the flame of the torches streamed sideways into the air, like the unfurled pennon of a chieftain. Magnificence there was, with some rude attempt at taste, but of comfort there was little, and, being unknown, it was unmissed. The Lady Rowena, with three of her attendants standing at her back and arranging her hair ere she lay down to rest, was seated in the sort of throne already mentioned, and looked as if born to exact general homage. The pilgrim acknowledged her claim to it by a low genuflection. "Rise, Palmer," said she graciously. "The defender of the absent has a right to favourable reception from all who value truth and honour manhood." She then said to her train, "Retire, excepting only Elgitha. I would speak with this holy pilgrim." The maidens, without leaving the apartment, retired to its further extremity and sat down on a small bench against the wall, where they remained mute as statues, though at such a distance that their whispers could not have interrupted the conversation of their mistress. "Pilgrim," said the lady after a moment's pause, during which she seemed uncertain how to address him, "you this night mentioned a name. I mean," she said with a sort of effort, "the name of Ivanhoe, in the halls where by nature and kindred it should have sounded most acceptably. And yet, such is the perverse course of fate, that of many whose hearts must have throbbed at the sound, I only dare ask you where, and in what condition, you left him of whom you spoke. We heard that, having remained in Palestine on account of his impaired health, after the departure of the English army, he had experienced the persecution of the French faction, to whom the Templars are known to be attached."
"I know little of the Knight of Ivanhoe," answered the palmer with a troubled voice. "I would I knew him better, since you, lady, are interested in his fate. He hath, I believe, surmounted the persecution of his enemies in Palestine, and is on the eve of returning to England, where you, lady, must know better than I what is his chance of happiness." The Lady Rowena sighed deeply, and asked more particularly when the Knight of Ivanhoe might be expected in his native country, and whether he would not be exposed to great dangers by the road. On the first point, the palmer professed ignorance. On the second, he said that the voyage might be safely made by the way of Venice and Genoa, and from thence through France to England. "Ivanhoe," he said, "was so well acquainted with the language and manners of the French that there was no fear of his incurring any hazard during that part of his travels." "Would to God," said the Lady Rowena, "he were here safely arrived, and able to bear arms in the approaching tourney, in which the chivalry of this land are expected to display their address and valour. Should Athelstane of Coningsborough obtain the prize, Ivanhoe is like to hear evil tidings when he reaches England. How looked he, stranger, when you last saw him? Had disease laid her hand heavy upon his strength and comeliness?" "He was darker," said the palmer, "and thinner than when he came from Cyprus in the train of Coeur de Lion, and care seemed to sit heavy on his brow. But I approached not his presence, because he is unknown to me." "He will," said the lady, "I fear, find little in his native land to clear those clouds from his countenance. Thanks, good pilgrim, for your information concerning the companion of my childhood." "Maidens," she said, "draw near. Offer the sleeping cup to this holy man, whom I will no longer detain from repose." One of the maidens presented a silver cup, containing a rich mixture of wine and spice, which Rowena barely put to her lips. It was then offered to the palmer, who, after a low obeisance, tasted a few drops. "Accept this alms, friend," continued the lady, offering a piece of gold, "in acknowledgment of thy painful travel, and of the shrines thou hast visited." The palmer accepted the boon with another low reverence, and followed Elgitha out of the apartment. In the anteroom he found his attendant, Anwold, who, taking the torch from the hand of the waiting maid, conducted him with more haste than ceremony to an exterior and ignoble part of the building, where a number of small apartments, or rather cells,
served for sleeping places to the lower order of domestics and to strangers of mean degree. "In which of these sleeps the Jew?" said the pilgrim.
"The unbelieving dog," answered Anwold, "kennels in the cell next your holiness. St. Dunstan, how it must be scraped and cleansed ere it be again fit for a Christian!"
"And where sleeps Girth, the swineherd?" said he.
"Girth," replied the bondsman, "sleeps in the cell on your right, as the Jew in that to your left. You serve to keep the child of circumcision separate from the abomination of his tribe. You might have occupied a more honourable place had you accepted of Oswald's invitation."
"It is well as it is," said the palmer. "The company, even of a Jew, can hardly spread contamination through an oaken partition." So saying, he entered the cabin allotted to him, and, taking the torch from the domestic's hand, thanked him and wished him good night. Having shut the door of his cell, he placed the torch in a candlestick made of wood and looked around his sleeping apartment, the furniture of which was of the most simple kind. It consisted of a rude wooden stool and still ruder hutch or bed frame stuffed with clean straw and accommodated with two or three sheep's skins by way of bedclothes. The palmer, having extinguished his torch, threw himself, without taking off any part of his clothes, on this rude couch, and slept, or at least retained his recumbent posture, until the earliest sunbeams found their way through the little grated window, which served at once to admit both air and light to his uncomfortable cell. He then started up, and after repeating his matins and adjusting his dress, he left it and entered that of Isaac the Jew, lifting the latch as gently as he could. The inmate was lying in troubled slumber upon a couch similar to that on which the palmer himself had passed the night. Such parts of his dress as the Jew had laid aside on the preceding evening were disposed carefully around his person, as if to prevent the hazard of their being abstracted during his slumbers. There was a trouble on his brow, amounting almost to agony. His hands and arms moved convulsively, as if struggling with a nightmare, and besides several ejaculations in Hebrew, the following were distinctly heard in the Norman English, or mixed language of the country. "For the sake of the God of Abraham, spare an unhappy old man. I am poor, I am penniless. Should your irons wrench my limbs asunder, I could not gratify you." The palmer awaited not the end of the Jew's vision, but stirred him with his pilgrim staff. The touch, probably associated, as is usual, with some of the apprehensions excited by his dream, for the old man started up, his grey hair standing almost erect upon his head, and, huddling some part of his garments about him, while he held the detached pieces with the tenacious grasp of a falcon, he fixed upon the palmer his keen black eyes, expressive of wild surprise and of bodily apprehension. "Fear nothing from me, Isaac," said the palmer. "I come as your friend."
"The God of Israel requite you," said the Jew, greatly relieved. "I dreamed, but Father Abraham be praised, it was but a dream."
Then, collecting himself, he added in his usual tone,
"And what may it be your pleasure to want at so early an hour with the poor Jew?"
"It is to tell you," said the palmer, "that if you leave not this mansion instantly, and travel not with some haste, your journey may prove a dangerous one."
"Holy Father," said the Jew,
"whom could it interest to endanger so poor a wretch as I am?"
"The purpose you can best guess," said the pilgrim, "but rely on this, that when the Templar crossed the hall yesternight, he spoke to his Mussulman slaves in the Saracen language, which I well understand, and charged them this morning to watch the journey of the Jew, to seize upon him when at a convenient distance from the mansion, and to conduct him to the castle of Philippe de Malvoisin, or to that of Reginald Front de Boeuf." It is impossible to describe the extremity of terror which seized upon the Jew at this information, and seemed at once to overpower his whole faculties. His arms fell down to his sides, and his head drooped on his breast, his knees bent under his weight. Every nerve and muscle of his frame seemed to collapse and lose its energy, and he sunk at the foot of the palmer, not in the fashion of one who intentionally stoops, kneels, or prostrates himself to excite compassion, but like a man borne down on all sides by the pressure of some invisible force which crushes him to the earth without the power of resistance.
"Holy God of Abraham!"
was his first exclamation, folding and elevating his wrinkled hands, but without raising his grey head from the pavement.
"Oh, holy Moses! Oh, blessed Aaron! The dream is not dreamed for naught, and the vision cometh not in vain. I feel their irons already tear my sinews. I feel the rack pass over my body like the saws and harrows and axes of iron over the men of Rabbah and of the cities of the children of Ammon."
"Stand up, Isaac, and hearken to me," said the palmer, who viewed the extremity of his distress with a compassion in which contempt was largely mingled. "You have cause for your terror, considering how your brethren have been used, in order to extort from them their hoards, both by princes and nobles. But stand up, I say, and I will point out to you the means of escape. Leave this mansion instantly, while its inmates sleep sound after the last night's revel. I will guide you by the secret paths of the forest, known as well to me as to any forester that ranges it, and I will not leave you till you are under safe conduct of some chief or baron going to the tournament, whose goodwill you have probably the means of securing." As the ears of Isaac received the hopes of escape which this speech intimated, he began gradually, and inch by inch as it were, to raise himself up from the ground, until he fairly rested upon his knees, throwing back his long grey hair and beard, and fixing his keen black eyes upon the palmer's face, with a look expressive at once of hope and fear, not unmingled with suspicion. But when he heard the concluding part of the sentence, his original terror appeared to revive in full force, and he dropped once more on his face, exclaiming,
"I possess the means of securing goodwill? Alas, there is but one road to the favour of a Christian, and how can the poor Jew find it, whom extortions have already reduced to the misery of Lazarus?"
Then, as if suspicion had overpowered his other feelings, he suddenly exclaimed,
"For the love of God, young man, betray me not! For the sake of the great Father who made us all, Jew as well as Gentile, Israelite and Ishmaelite, do me no treason! I have not means to secure the goodwill of a Christian beggar, were he rating it at a single penny."
As he said these last words, he raised himself and grasped the palmer's mantle with a look of the most earnest entreaty. The pilgrim extricated himself as if there were contamination in the touch. "Wert thou loaded with all the wealth of thy tribe," he said, "what interest have I to injure thee? In this dress I am vowed to poverty, nor do I change it for aught save a horse and a coat of mail. Yet think not that I care for thy company, or propose myself advantage by it. Remain here if thou wilt. Cedric the Saxon may protect thee."
"Alas," said the Jew, "he will not let me travel in his train. Saxon or Norman will be equally ashamed of the poor Israelite, and to travel by myself through the domains of Philip de Malvoisin and Reginald Front de Boeuf, good youth, I will go with you. Let us haste, let us gird up our loins, let us flee. Here is thy staff, why wilt thou tarry?"
"I tarry not," said the pilgrim, giving way to the urgency of his companion, "but I must secure the means of leaving this place. Follow me." He led the way to the adjoining cell, which, as the reader is apprised, was occupied by Gurth, the swineherd.
"Arise, Gurth," said the pilgrim, "undo the postern gate, and let out the Jew and me."
Gurth, whose occupation, though now held so mean, gave him as much consequence in Saxon England as that of Eumaeus and Ithaca, was offended at the familiar and commanding tone assumed by the palmer.
"The Jew leaving Rotherwood,"
said he, raising himself on his elbow and looking superciliously at him without quitting his pallet,
"and travelling in company with a palmer to boot."
"I should as soon have dreamt," said Wamba, who entered the apartment at the instant, "of his stealing away with a gammon of bacon."
"Nevertheless," said Gurth,
again laying down his head on the wooden log which served him for a pillow,
Both Jew and Gentile must be content to abide the opening of the great gate. We suffer no visitors to depart by stealth at these unseasonable hours. Nevertheless, said the pilgrim in a commanding tone, you will not, I think, refuse me that favour.
So saying, he stooped over the bed of the recumbent swineherd and whispered something in his ear in Saxon. Girth started up as if electrified. The pilgrim, raising his finger in an attitude as if to express caution, added, Girth, beware. Thou art wont to be prudent. I say, undo the postern. Thou shalt know more anon. With hasty alacrity, Girth obeyed him, while Womba and the Jew followed, both wondering at the sudden change in the swineherd's demeanour.
My mule! My mule!
Said the Jew as soon as they stood without the postern. Fetch him his mule, said the pilgrim, and, hearest thou, let me have another, that I may bear him company till he is beyond these parts. I will return it safely to some of Cedric's train at Ashby, and do thou... He whispered the rest in Girth's ear.
Willingly, most willingly shall it be done,
said Girth, and instantly departed to execute the commission.
I wish I knew,
said Womba, when his comrade's back was turned, what you palmers learn in the Holy Land.
To say our prayers, fool, answered the pilgrim, to repent our sins, and to mortify ourselves with fasting, vigils, and long prayers.
Something more potent than that, answered the jester, for when would repentance or prayer make Girth do a courtesy, or fasting or vigil persuade him to lend you a mule? I trow you might as well have told his favourite black boar of thy vigils and penance, and wouldst have gotten as civil an answer.
Go to, said the pilgrim, thou art but a Saxon fool.
Thou sayest well, said the jester. Had I been born a Norman, as I think thou art, I would have had luck on my side, and been next door to a wise man.
At this moment, Girth appeared on the opposite side of the moat with the mules. The travellers crossed the ditch, upon a drawbridge of only 2 planks' breadth, the narrowness of which was matched with the straightness of the postern, and with a little wicket in the exterior palisade which gave access to the forest. No sooner had they reached the mules than the Jew, with hasty and trembling hands, secured upon the saddle a small bag of blue buckram, which he took from under his cloak, containing, as he muttered,
a change of raiment, only a change of raiment.
Then, getting upon the animal with more alacrity and haste than could have been anticipated from his years, he lost no time in so disposing the skirts of his gabardine as to conceal completely from observation the burthen which he had thus exposed en croupe. The pilgrim mounted with more deliberation, reaching as he departed his hand to Girth, who kissed it with the utmost possible veneration. The swineherd stood gazing after the travellers, until they were lost under the boughs of the forest path, when he was disturbed from his reverie by the voice of Womba.
"Knowest thou," said the jester, my good friend Girth, "that thou art strangely courteous and most unwontedly pious on this summer morning. I would I were a black prior or a barefoot palmer to avail myself of thy unwonted zeal and courtesy. Certes, I would make more out of it than a kiss of the hand."
"Thou art no fool thus far, Womba," answered Girth, "though thou arguest from appearances, and the wisest of us can do no more. But it is time for us to look after my charge."
So saying, he turned back to the mansion, attended by the jester. Meanwhile, the travellers continued to press on their journey with a dispatch which argued the extremity of the Jew's fears, since persons at his age are seldom fond of rapid motion. The palmer, to whom every path and outlet in the wood appeared to be familiar, led the way through the most devious paths, and more than once excited anew the suspicion of the Israelite that he intended to betray him into some ambuscade of his enemies. His doubts might have been indeed pardoned, for, except perhaps the flying fish, there was no race existing on the earth, in the air or the waters, who were the object of such an unintermitting, general and relentless persecution as the Jews of this period. upon the slightest and most unreasonable pretences, as well as upon accusations the most absurd and groundless, their persons and property were exposed to every turn of popular fury. For Norman, Saxon, Dane, and Briton, however adverse these races were to each other, contended which should look with greatest detestation upon a people whom it was accounted a point of religion to hate, to revile, to despise, to plunder, and to persecute. The kings of the Norman race and the independent nobles, who followed their example in all acts of tyranny, maintained against this devoted people a persecution of a more regular, calculated, and self-interested kind. It is a well-known story of King John that he confined a wealthy Jew in one of the royal castles and daily caused one of his teeth to be torn out, until, when the jaw of the unhappy Israelite was half disfurnished, he consented to pay a large sum, which it was the tyrant's object to extort from him. The little ready money which was in the country was chiefly in possession of this persecuted people, and the nobility hesitated not to follow the example of their sovereign in wringing it from them by every species of oppression and even personal torture. Yet the passive courage inspired by the love of gain induced the Jews to dare the various evils to which they were subjected in consideration of the immense profits which they were enabled to realize in a country naturally so wealthy as England. In spite of every species of discouragement, and even of a special court of taxations called the Jews' Exchequer, erected for the very purpose of despoiling and distressing them, the Jews increased, multiplied, and accumulated huge sums, which they transferred from one hand to another by means of bills of exchange, an invention for which commerce is said to be indebted to them, and which enabled them to transfer their wealth from land to land, that when threatened with oppression in one country, their treasure might be secured in another. The obstinacy and avarice of the Jews being thus in a measure placed in opposition to the fanaticism and tyranny of those under whom they lived, seemed, as it were, to increase in proportion to the persecution with which they were visited, and the immense wealth they usually acquired in commerce, while it frequently placed them in danger, was at other times used to extend their influence and to secure to them a certain degree of protection. On these terms they lived, and their character, influenced accordingly, was watchful, suspicious, and timid, yet obstinate, uncomplying, and skilful in evading the dangers to which they were exposed. When the travellers had pushed on, at a rapid rate, through many devious paths, the palmer at length broke silence. "That large, decayed oak," he said, "marks the boundaries over which Front de Boeuf claims authority. We are long since far from those of Malvoisin. There is now no fear of pursuit."
"May the wheels of their chariots be taken off," said the Jew, "like those of the host of Pharaoh, that they may drive heavily. But leave me not, good pilgrim. Think but of that fierce and savage Templar with his Saracen slaves. They will regard neither territory, nor manor, nor lordship."
"Our road," said the palmer, "should here separate, for it beseems not men of my character and thine to travel together longer than needs must be. Besides, what succour couldst thou have from me, a peaceful pilgrim, against two armed heathens?"
"Oh, good youth," answered the Jew,
"thou canst defend me, and I know thou wouldst. Poor as I am, I will requite it. Not with money, for money, so help me my father Abraham, I have none, but—"
"Money and recompense," said the palmer, interrupting him, "I have already said I require not of thee. Guide thee I can, and it may be even defend thee, since to protect a Jew against a Saracen can scarce be accounted unworthy of a Christian. Therefore, Jew, I will see thee safe under some fitting escort. We are now not far from the town of Sheffield, where thou mayst easily find many of thy tribe with whom to take refuge."
"The blessing of Jacob be upon thee, good youth," said the Jew. "In Sheffield I can harbour with my kinsman Zareth, and find some means of travelling forth with safety."
"Be it so," said the palmer. "At Sheffield, then, we part, and half an hour's riding will bring us in sight of that town." The half hour was spent in perfect silence on both parts, the pilgrim perhaps disdaining to address the Jew, except in case of absolute necessity, and the Jew not presuming to force a conversation with a person whose journey to the Holy Sepulchre gave a sort of sanctity to his character. They paused on the top of a gently rising bank, and the pilgrim, pointing to the town of Sheffield, which lay beneath them, repeated the words, "Here, then, we part." "Not till you have had the poor Jew's thanks," said Isaac, "for I presume not to ask you to go with me to my kinsman Zareth's, who might aid me with some means of repaying your good offices." "I have already said," answered the pilgrim, "that I desire no recompense. If, among the huge list of thy debtors, thou wilt, for my sake, spare the gyves and the dungeon to some unhappy Christian who stands in thy danger, I shall hold this morning service to thee well bestowed."
"Stay, stay," said the Jew, laying hold of his garment. "Something would I do more than this, something for thyself. God knows the Jew is poor. Yes, Isaac is the beggar of his tribe, but forgive me should I guess what thou most lackest at this moment."
"If thou wert to guess truly," said the palmer, "it is what thou canst not supply. Wert thou as wealthy as thou sayst thou art poor."
"As I say," echoed the Jew. "Oh, believe it, I say but the truth. I am a plundered, indebted, distressed man. Hard hands have wrung from me my goods, my money, my ships, and all that I possessed. Yet I can tell thee what thou lackest, and, it may be, supply it too. Thy wish even now is for a horse and armour."
The palmer started, and turned suddenly towards the Jew.
"What fiend prompted that guess?" said he hastily.
"No matter," said the Jew, smiling. "Though it be a true one, and as I can guess thy want, so I can supply it."
"But consider," said the palmer, "my character, my dress, my vow."
"I know you Christians," replied the Jew, "and that the noblest of you will take the staff and sandal in superstitious penance and walk afoot to visit the graves of dead men. Blaspheme not, Jew," said the pilgrim sternly.
"Forgive me," said the Jew, "I spoke rashly. But there dropped words from you last night and this morning that, like sparks from flint, showed the metal within, and in the bosom of that palmer's gown is hidden a knight's chain and spurs of gold. They glanced as you stooped over my bed in the morning."
The pilgrim could not forbear smiling. "Were thy garments searched by as curious an eye, Isaac?" said he.
"What discoveries might not be made?"
"No more of that," said the Jew, changing colour, and drawing forth his writing materials in haste, as if to stop the conversation, he began to write upon a piece of paper which he supported on the top of his yellow cap, without dismounting from his mule. When he had finished, he delivered the scroll, which was in the Hebrew character, to the pilgrim, saying,
"In the town of Leicester, all men know the rich Jew, Kirjath Jairam of Lombardy. Give him this scroll. He hath on sale 6 Milan harnesses. The worst would suit a crowned head. 10 goodly steeds. The worst might mount a king, were he to do battle for his throne. Of these he will give thee thy choice, with everything else that can furnish thee forth for the tournament. When it is over, thou wilt return them safely, unless thou shouldst have wherewith to pay their value to the owner."
"But, Isaac," said the pilgrim, smiling, "dost thou know that in these sports the arms and steed of the knight who is unhorsed are forfeit to his victor? Now I may be unfortunate, and so lose what I cannot replace or repay." The Jew looked somewhat astounded at this possibility, but collecting his courage, he replied hastily,
"No, no, no, it is impossible. I will not think so. The blessing of our Father will be upon thee. Thy lance will be powerful as the rod of Moses."
So saying, he was turning his mule's head away, when the palmer, in his turn, took hold of his gabardine.
"Nay, but Isaac, thou knowest not all the risk. The steed may be slain, the armour injured, for I will spare neither horse nor man.
Besides, those of thy tribe give nothing for nothing. Something there must be paid for their use." The Jew twisted himself in his saddle, like a man in a fit of the colic, but his better feelings predominated over those which were most familiar to him.
"I care not," he said. "I care not. Let me go. If there is damage, it will cost you nothing. If there is usage money, Kirath Jairam will forgive it for the sake of his kinsman Isaac. Fare thee well. Yet, hark thee, good youth," said he, turning about, "thrust thyself not too forward into this vain hurly-burly. I speak not for endangering the steed and coat of armour, but for the sake of thine own life and limbs."
"Gramercy for thy caution," said the palmer, again smiling. "I will use thy courtesy frankly, and it will go hard with me, but I will requite it." They parted, and took different roads for the town of Sheffield.
Chapter 7 Knights, with a long retinue of their squires, in gaudy liveries march and quaint attires. One laced the helm, another held the lance, a third the shining buckler did advance. The courser pawed the ground with restless feet, and snorting foamed and champed the golden bit. The smiths and armourers on palfreys ride, files in their hands and hammers at their side, and nails for loosened spears and thongs for shields provide. The yeomen guard the streets in seemly bands, and clans come crowding on with cudgels in their hands. Palamon and Arcite. The condition of the English nation was at this time sufficiently miserable. King Richard was absent, a prisoner, and in the power of the perfidious and cruel Duke of Austria. Even the very place of his captivity was uncertain, and his fate but very imperfectly known to the generality of his subjects, who were, in the meantime, a prey to every species of subaltern oppression. Prince John, in league with Philip of France, Richard's mortal enemy, was using every species of influence with the Duke of Austria to prolong the captivity of his brother Richard, to whom he stood indebted for so many favours. In the meantime, he was strengthening his faction in the kingdom, of which he proposed to dispute the succession, in case of the king's death, with the legitimate heir, Arthur, Duke of Brittany, son of Geoffrey Plantagenet, the elder brother of John. This usurpation, it is well known, he afterwards effected. His own character being light, profligate, and perfidious, John easily attached to his person and faction not only all who had reason to dread the resentment of Richard for proceedings during his absence, but also the numerous class of lawless resolutes, whom the Crusades had turned back on their country, accomplished in the vices of the East, impoverished in substance, and hardened in character, and who placed their hopes of harvest in civil commotion. To these causes of public distress and apprehension fall to be added the multitude of outlaws, who, driven to despair by the oppression of the feudal nobility and the severe exercise of the forest laws, banded together in large gangs, and, keeping possession of the forests and the wastes, set at defiance the justice and magistracy of the country. The nobles themselves, each fortified within his own castle, and playing the petty sovereign over his own domains, were the leaders of bands scarce less lawless and oppressive than those of the avowed depredators. To maintain these retainers, and to support the extravagance and magnificence which their pride induced them to affect, the nobility borrowed sums of money from the Jews at the most usurious interest, which gnawed into their estates like consuming cankers, scarce to be cured unless when circumstances gave them an opportunity of getting free by exercising upon their creditors some act of unprincipled violence. Under the various burdens imposed by this unhappy state of affairs, the people of England suffered deeply for the present, and had yet more dreadful cause to fear for the future. To augment their misery, a contagious disorder of a dangerous nature spread through the land, and rendered more virulent by the uncleanness, the indifferent food, and the wretched lodging of the lower classes, swept off many whose fate the survivors were tempted to envy, as exempting them from the evils which were to come. Yet amid these accumulated distresses, the poor as well as the rich, the vulgar as well as the noble, in the event of a tournament, which was the grand spectacle of that age, felt as much interest as the half-starved citizen of Madrid, who has not a real left to buy provisions for his family, feels in the issue of a bull feast. Neither duty nor infirmity could keep youth or age from such exhibitions. The passage of arms, as it was called, which was to take place at Ashby in the county of Leicester, as champions of the first renown were to take the field in the presence of Prince John himself, who was expected to grace the lists, had attracted universal attention, and an immense confluence of persons of all ranks hastened upon the appointed morning to the place of combat. The scene was singularly romantic. On the verge of a wood, which approached to within a mile of the town of Ashby, was an extensive meadow of the finest and most beautiful green turf, surrounded on one side by the forest, and fringed on the other by straggling oak trees, some of which had grown to an immense size. The ground, as if fashioned on purpose for the martial display which was intended, sloped gradually down on all sides to a level bottom, which was enclosed for the lists with strong palisades, forming a space of a quarter of a mile in length and about half as broad. The form was square, save that the corners were considerably rounded off, in order to afford more convenience for the spectators. The openings for the entry of the combatants were at the northern and southern extremities of the lists, accessible by strong wooden gates, each wide enough to admit two horsemen riding abreast. At each of these portals were stationed two heralds, attended by six trumpets, as many pursuivants, and a strong body of men-at-arms for maintaining order and ascertaining the quality of the knights who proposed to engage in this martial game. On a platform beyond the southern entrance, formed by a natural elevation of the ground, were pitched five magnificent pavilions, adorned with pennons of russet and black, the chosen colour of the five knights' challengers. The cords of the tents were of the same colour. Before each pavilion was suspended the shield of the knight by whom it was occupied, and beside it stood his squire, quaintly disguised as a savage or sylvan man, or in some other fantastic dress, according to the taste of his master, and the character which he was pleased to assume during the game. The central pavilion, as the place of honour, had been assigned to Brion de Bois-Guilbert, whose renown, in all games of chivalry, no less than his connection with the knights who had undertaken this passage of arms, had occasioned him to be eagerly received into the company of the challengers, and even adopted as a chief. On one side of his tent were pitched those of Reginald Front de Boeuf and Philippe de Malvoisin, and on the other was the pavilion of Hugh de Grandmesnil, a noble baron in the vicinity, whose ancestor had been Lord High Steward of England in the time of the Conqueror and his son William Rufus. Ralph de Vipont, a knight of St. John of Jerusalem, who had some ancient possessions at a place called Heather, near Ashby de la Zouche, occupied the fifth pavilion. From the entrance into the lists, a gently sloping passage, 10 yards in breadth, led up to the platform on which the tents were pitched. It was strongly secured by a palisade on each side, as was the esplanade in front of the pavilions, and the whole was guarded by men-at-arms. The northern access to the lists terminated in a similar entrance of 30 feet in breadth, at the extremity of which was a large enclosed space for such knights as might be disposed to enter the lists with the challengers, behind which were placed tents containing refreshments of every kind for their accommodation, with armourers, farriers, and other attendants in readiness to give their services wherever they were necessary. The exterior of the lists was in part occupied by temporary galleries spread with tapestry and carpets, and accommodated with cushions for the convenience of those ladies and nobles who were expected to attend upon the tournament. A narrow space betwixt these galleries and the lists gave accommodation for yeomanry and spectators of a better degree than the mere vulgar, and might be compared to the pit of a theatre. The promiscuous multitude arranged themselves upon large banks of turf prepared for the purpose, which, aided by the natural elevation of the ground, enabled them to look over the galleries and obtain a fair view into the lists. Besides the accommodation which these stations afforded, many hundreds had perched themselves on the branches of the trees which surrounded the meadow, and even the steeple of a country church, at some distance, was crowded with spectators. It only remains to notice, respecting the general arrangement, that one gallery in the very centre of the eastern side of the lists, and consequently exactly opposite to the spot where the shock of the combat must take place, was raised higher than the others, more richly decorated, and graced by a sort of throne and canopy on which the royal arms were emblazoned. Squires, pages, and yeomen in rich liveries waited around this place of honour, which was designed for Prince John and his attendants. Opposite to this royal gallery was another, elevated to the same height on the western side of the lists, and more gaily, if less sumptuously decorated, than that destined for the prince himself. A train of pages and of young maidens, the most beautiful who could be selected, gaily dressed in fancy habits of green and pink, surrounded a throne decorated with the same colours. Among pennons and flags bearing wounded hearts, burning hearts, bleeding hearts, bows and quivers, and all the commonplace emblems of the triumphs of Cupid, a blazoned inscription informed the spectators that this seat of honour was designed for la reine de la beauté et des amours. But who the queen of beauty and of love was to prove, no one was prepared to guess. Meanwhile, spectators of every description thronged forwards to occupy their respective stations, and not without many quarrels concerning those which they were entitled to hold. Some of these were settled by the men-at-arms with brief ceremony, the shafts of their battle-axes and pummels of their swords being readily employed as arguments to convince the most refractory. Others, which involved the rank of more elevated persons, were determined by the heralds, or by the two marshals of the field, William de Wivel and Stephen de Martival, who, armed at all points, rode up and down the lists to enforce and preserve good order among the spectators. Gradually the galleries became filled with knights and nobles in their robes of peace, whose long and rich-tinted mantles were contrasted with the gayer and more splendid habits of the ladies, that, in a greater proportion than even the men themselves, thronged to witness a sport which one would have thought too bloody and dangerous to afford them much pleasure. The lower and interior space was soon filled by substantial yeomen and burghers, and such of the lesser gentry as, from modesty, poverty, or dubious title, durst not assume any higher place. It was, of course, amongst these that the most frequent disputes for precedence occurred.
"Dog of an unbeliever!"
said an old man, whose threadbare tunic bore witness to his poverty, as his sword and dagger and golden chain intimated his pretensions to rank.
"Whelp of a she-wolf! Darest thou press upon a Christian and a Norman gentleman of the blood of Montdidier?"
This rough expostulation was addressed to no other than our acquaintance Isaac, who, richly and even magnificently dressed in a gabardine ornamented with lace and lined with fur, endeavoured to make place in the foremost row beneath the gallery for his daughter, the beautiful Rebecca, who had joined him at Ashby and who was now hanging on her father's arm, not a little terrified for the displeasure which seemed generally excited by her parents' presumption. But Isaac, though we have seen him sufficiently timid upon other occasions, knew well that upon the present he had nothing to fear. It was not in places of general resort, or where their equals were assembled, that any avaricious or malevolent noble durst offer him injury. On such occasions the Jews were under the protection of the general law, and if that proved a weak assurance, it usually happened that there were among the persons assembled some barons, who, for their own interested motives, were ready to act as their protectors. On the present occasion, Isaac felt more than usually confident, being aware that Prince John was even then in the very act of negotiating a large loan from the Jews of York to be secured upon certain jewels and lands. Isaac's own share in this transaction was considerable, and he well knew that the prince's eager desire to bring it to a conclusion would ensure him his protection in the dilemma in which he stood. Emboldened by these considerations, the Jew pursued his point and jostled the Norman Christian without respect either to his descent, quality, or religion. The complaints of the old man, however, excited the indignation of the bystanders. One of these, a stout, well-set yeoman, arrayed in Lincoln green, having 12 arrows in his belt, with a baldric and badge of silver, and a bow of 6 feet length in his hand, turned short round and while his countenance, which constant exposure to weather had rendered brown as a hazelnut, grew darker with anger, he advised the Jew to remember that all the wealth he had acquired by sucking the blood of his miserable victims had but swelled him like a bottled spider, which might be overlooked while it kept in a corner, but would be crushed if it ventured into the light. This intimation, delivered in Norman English, with a firm voice and a stern aspect, made the Jew shrink back, and he would have probably withdrawn himself altogether from a vicinity so dangerous had not the attention of everyone been called to the sudden entrance of Prince John, who even then entered the lists, attended by a numerous and gay train, consisting partly of laymen, partly of churchmen, as light in their dress and as gay in their demeanour as their companions. Among the latter was the prior of Jorvaux, in the most gallant trim which a dignitary of the church could exhibit. Fur and gold was not spared in his garments, and the points of his boots, out-heroding the preposterous fashion of the time, turned up so very far as to be attached not to his knees merely, but to his very girdle, and effectually prevented him from putting his foot into the stirrup. This, however, was a slight inconvenience to the gallant abbot, who perhaps even rejoiced in the opportunity to display his accomplished horsemanship before so many spectators, especially of the fair sex. The rest of Prince John's retinue consisted of the favourite leaders of his mercenary troops, some marauding barons and profligate attendants upon the court, with several Knights Templars and Knights of St. John. It may be here remarked that the knights of these two orders were accounted hostile to King Richard, having adopted the side of Philip of France in the long train of disputes which took place betwixt that monarch and the lion-hearted King of England. It was the well-known consequence of this discord that Richard's repeated victories were rendered fruitless, his romantic attempts to besiege Jerusalem were disappointed, and the fruit of all the glory which he had acquired dwindled into an uncertain truce with the Sultan Saladin. With the same policy which had dictated the conduct of their brethren in the Holy Land, the Templars and Hospitallers in England and Normandy attached themselves to the faction of Prince John, having little reason to desire the return of Richard to England or the succession of Arthur, his legitimate heir. For the opposite reason, Prince John hated and contemned the few Saxon families of consequence which subsisted in England, and omitted no opportunity of mortifying and affronting them, being conscious that his person and pretensions were disliked by them as well as by the greater part of the English commons, who feared farther innovation upon their rights and liberties from a sovereign of John's licentious and tyrannical disposition. Attended by this gallant equipage, himself well mounted and splendidly dressed in crimson and in gold, bearing upon his hand a falcon, and having his head covered by a rich fur bonnet adorned with a circle of precious stones, from which his long curled hair escaped and overspread his shoulders, Prince John, upon a grey and high-mettled palfrey, caracoled within the lists at the head of his jovial party, laughing loud with his train, and eyeing with all the boldness of royal criticism the beauties who adorned the lofty galleries. Those who remarked in the countenance of the prince a dissolute audacity, mingled with extreme haughtiness and indifference to the feelings of others, could not yet deny to his countenance that sort of comeliness which belongs to an open set of features, well formed by nature, modelled by art to the usual rules of courtesy, yet so far frank and honest that they seemed as if they disclaimed to conceal the natural workings of the soul. Such an expression is often mistaken for manly frankness, when in truth it arises from the reckless indifference of a libertine disposition, conscious of superiority of birth, of wealth, or of some other adventitious advantage, totally unconnected with personal merit. To those who did not think so deeply, and they were the greater number by 100 to 1, the splendour of Prince John's reino, i.e. fur tippet, of his cloak lined with the most costly sables, his maroquin boots and golden spurs, together with the grace with which he managed his palfrey, were sufficient to merit their clamorous applause. In his joyous caracole round the lists, the attention of the prince was called by the commotion, not yet subsided, which had attended the ambitious movement of Isaac towards the higher places of the assembly. The quick eye of Prince John instantly recognized the Jew, but was much more agreeably attracted by the beautiful daughter of Zion, who, terrified by the tumult, clung close to the arm of her aged father. The figure of Rebecca might indeed have compared with the proudest beauties of England, even though it had been judged by as shrewd a connoisseur as Prince John. Her form was exquisitely symmetrical, and was shown to advantage by a sort of Eastern dress, which she wore according to the fashion of the females of her nation. Her turban of yellow silk suited well with the darkness of her complexion. The brilliancy of her eyes, the superb arch of her eyebrows, her well-formed aquiline nose, her teeth as white